Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
Okay, so what are we doing this hour? Let's lay it out.
I'll say it in one word. We can just make this very crisp.
Do it.
Juice.
Juice.
Juice. The word juice, it means, well, what does it mean? It means plugging in something into a wall socket, out comes
juice.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's also, of course, the...
Well, you don't like the sound of it, but that's how people sound when they drink.
Gives me chills.
Drinking juice. Drinking juice. Okay.
All right, so two different kinds of juice is what you're saying.
And two different stories.
All right. This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Soren Wheeler. And this...
Electricity.
Right. If you want to sit there.
Okay.
And I don't know, can you hear anyone?
Can I hear anyone?
I don't know. Can you hear anyone?
Oh my God, Soren, hi.
So you know this
Thank
person.
You. Yes, I do. I do.
This is Sally Ady.
How are you?
We went to school together a long time ago, but these days she's an editor.
At New Scientist in London.
And the reason I called her into the studio is because of something that happened to her when she was working on a story for them.
Yes, this was a story that I'd been chasing for years and years.
Began for her?
In 2007. At DARPA Tech.
Which is a big gathering of like weapons developers and researchers.
It's like 5,000 guys all, you know, looking like Agent Smith from The Matrix, you know, looking at the latest war toys.
Drones, bazookas. Anyway, at some point she starts talking to this woman.
And she was telling me about her program, which was that they had figured out how to apply sort of electrical current to the brain in order to accelerate the learning process. And I was like, no
So what Sally had stumbled into was something called TDCS, stands for transcranial direct current stimulation. The idea is you take a couple little electrodes, you place them on your scalp, connected with wires to a battery, you send a little bit of electricity into your brain, and then all kinds of things happen, if you believe the claims.
But
for Sally, it started with a casual afternoon of
sniper training.
So after that conversation at the conference, she tracked down a group in Carlsbad, California.
It's about an hour and a half south of LA.
Who were using this brain-zapping stuff to train snipers.
And
after a late-night international flight and some LA traffic...
I haven't slept. I'm sleep-deprived.
Sally found herself at a place called Advanced Brain Monitoring, where they have a little room.
This little room where they've set up a little sort of 360-degree training simulation. So it's kind of like a video game. But it's like the full, kind of like the full room in front of you. And
like
so,
the whole wall is a screen?
Yes.
Not only that, she says, but all around you in this room are these props.
You're behind real sandbags, you know, in proper position. They teach you how to hold the rifle properly.
And the rifle, except for the fact that it shoots blanks, is basically the real deal.
Yeah, and then it's got a laser sight.
And they tell her, you know, okay, before we do this brain stimulation thing, we're actually going to have you do some training without it. So they get her all set up, they put her behind the sandbags, and they hit go.
You know, at first it starts out with really easy stuff, like you're shooting virtual targets that aren't people. And it's quite, it's realistic. You get the kickback from the CO2 cartridge, and then you get this like ding sound from when you hit, you know, the virtual metal target.
And then it starts getting harder. So there's people instead of targets, and then more and more people.
Until the highest level is you are at a checkpoint, like an Iraqi checkpoint, and everything's fine. And then all of a sudden, the Humvee in front of you blows up. And then from all over the place, dozens of people in suicide bomb vests start running at you with their rifles shooting you. And I'm just being blown the f*** up. I can't make the decisions fast enough.
She said there were just too many of them. She couldn't figure out who to shoot first.
It was so, oh God, and I was so tired, and I was so jet-lagged, and I was so bad at it. And it's funny because you think like, oh, whatever, that's a video game. But it's amazing how stressful that gets.
And at a certain point, the stress started getting to her.
Like, oh my God, this isn't going to be a story. And really, you just flew out to California for this?
She was not very good at it, and it kind of stressed her out.
And then this guy walked in the room.
Mike Wisand.
He's a neuroscientist.
Has put together this contraption.
What is that big box that's sitting in your lap there?
So this is a big red toolbox that we got literally from Sears.
Mike was actually passing through New York City, so we invited him into the studio.
And we have electrodes that allow us to deliver current.
You have a bunch of wires, I saw.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of batteries.
So
we take a set of electrodes.
One electrode is attached to my right temple.
Yep.
And the other electrode is attached by a different wire to my left arm.
And we turn on the juice.
Did it hurt?
It wasn't so much that. I suddenly tasted metal in my mouth. It tasted like I had licked the inside of an aluminum can. And then he's like, all right, try it again. I'm like, oh, I'm not exactly expecting different results. So they start me out again right at the really hard checkpoint one. The thing blows up. And then people start coming from all over the place. And I feel like they must have put it on an easy setting. Everything is just a little more straightforward. It's more obvious who I should pick off first. And I'm thinking to myself a little bit like, you know, when is this going to get really hard again? And then the, you know, intern or whoever comes in and turns on the lights. She's like, okay, you're done. I'm like, well, wait, that's not what, I've only been here for like 3 minutes. She's like, no, that was 20 minutes. I'm like, no, that's not true. And I look up and the clocks have all shifted by 20 minutes. And I swear to God, it was 3 minutes.
So almost every person that we put this on says they get into what they call a state of flow, where they don't recognize that the time is going by. They're just boom, 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 boom.
And I was like, did you guys make it easier? They're like, no, same level. I'm like, I think you guys made it easy.
When Sally did it with brain stimulation, she performed at 100% accuracy.
100%. I didn't leave anyone alive.
Now, what was she before?
I don't know, but she wasn't very good.
Roughly 3 out of 20 the first time and 20 out of 20 the second.
Yeah.
So wait, so you're saying with just a little electricity, she went from being like totally inept to like a trained killer?
Well, it's an N of one, so we can't go too far. But
I mean, this was just Sally's experience during this one demo, so it's not like a controlled study. But Mike has now used this device in a bunch of studies for the military.
Yep.
For example, he had one study with people looking at those
grainy black and white radar images,
trying to pick out, you know, what's an enemy vehicle and what isn't. And if he puts this device on their head while they're trying to learn how to do that,
we can double the rate of learning.
Really?
Well, how? I mean, what is it doing?
Okay, so what I think is that early on when you are learning something...
Mike says that when you're trying to learn how to do something that's kind of tough, what's happening is that you're trying a bunch of different things.
You try all kinds of different ways to solve the problem.
And occasionally, your brain is stumbling across an ideal sequence of neurons. Every so often, as you're practicing, all of a sudden, your brain is like... Oh, this, then this, then this, and this. Okay, that's it. But then it struggles to find that again, and it keeps messing up, and whatever. And if you look at an expert brain, you'll actually see that preferred circuit dialed in. Like they just do that over and over and over again, no more stumbling around. And so what Mike does is he figures out where that circuit is, and he gives it a little extra juice.
To, in essence, prime the pump.
So that expert circuit is more likely to fire, and you're more likely to stumble into it. And when you do stumble into it, you're more likely to stick with it.
That's right. That's how we think it works.
But are you sure of what you're hitting? I mean, like, you're putting electricity on the outside of people's heads. So are you able to target just a small cluster of brain cells, or is it a region that you're hitting, or like 1,000 cells?
What I'm talking about is millions of cells. Yeah,
that's a lot.
Is that precise enough to target the place where a task is being done in a brain, if it's a million?
In our work, yes.
And Mike claims that even though it's a blunt tool...
Yeah, this is not a scalpel. This is a sledgehammer.
If you know the right group of neurons or region of the brain to target, this can work with almost any task.
If you want to target... visual spatial learning, for example, searching an image, you'd put this on the right side of your head, roughly near the temple. But if you wanted to learn textual material, you can put this on the left side of your head, and it will have a similar effect.
If you wanted to learn textual
material. It can't be true.
No, it really
You mean if I want to learn irregular verbs in French, I get one of your things, I stick it on the part of my head that is good for grammar?
We haven't tested it with learning foreign languages, but if a native English speaker is learning a long English sentence, they can recall it with greater fidelity if they have this on their head while they study those sentences. And if you go right parietal, back over just behind your ear and up above your ear, you can learn math better.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It just, no matter what, it just seems like the next flavor of new age thing. So,
hello?
I started calling around.
My name is Peter Reiner, and I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia.
Cool. So Peter Reiner actually studies this whole field. He looks at public perception and the quality of research, and I just basically asked him, you know, is this for real? Like, if you have a healthy brain, you put a little electricity into it, has it been proven that that will enhance learning or whatever else they claim?
Well, maybe the best way to answer that is that the part of the reason that there's all this interest is that TDCS appears to be relatively effective.
And he says this is based on a lot of different studies in a lot of different areas.
But the key to what I just said is relatively. And so the caveat that I have to add is that pretty much all of the studies that have been done to date are relatively small.
He says it's early days, and the studies have been done have only been done with a few subjects.
Maybe 20 people, larger studies, 40 or 50.
Now, a lot of these studies do find a positive effect, but if you're a hard-nosed scientist, you know, those small sample sizes aren't enough to make a very big claim. Even so...
Turn it on, moment of truth.
The cat's kind of already out of the bag, because if you go on YouTube...
White flash... Really brief, really quick. That's cool.
You can find a surprisingly large number of videos of people experimenting with these devices.
I instantly feel very good, very calm, very safe, not really worried about anything.
A lot of the videos show you how to make your own.
First, we'll start with the circuit diagram.
You just go to Radio Shack and buy a few simple parts.
There's the battery. That's going to be your 9-volt.
And here's a few alligator clips, since I don't have any solder with me, although...
I have a switch in the circuit.
I mean, YouTube just seems to be filled with people who are trying to hotwire their own brain.
So for the past year, I've been wanting to increase my brain power, since I have probably below average brain power compared to normal people.
I want to study neurosciences, but...
All right, so I want to give you an update on using TDCS to learn a foreign language.
People are using this for a whole range of things, given how flexible the technique is.
That's Nick Fitz. He works with Peter Reiner, the guy we talked to earlier. And he says not only can you do a lot of different kinds of things with this device, on top of that, it's dirt cheap.
So let's say in the time that it takes me to listen to one of your episodes, I could probably go to the store, come back and build a TDCS device for around $20.
For $20?
Right. And so I'm, as I said,
I mean, is that something that makes you nervous?
I'll say first, I think the DIY community is quite thoughtful, but... It does make me nervous. There's some people that report loss of consciousness after using it. There are some people that are reporting feeling burns.
There's actually one report of somebody going temporarily blind.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which brings up the larger point, you know, that this device is kind of impossibly hard to regulate. Because a kid like this can put it anywhere he wants on his head, and if he moves it just a couple of inches, it could have a drastically different effect.
And that's really what is... a concern.
Because according to Peter Reiner, while we might like to think of the brain as being a bunch of separate circuits that do separate tasks, really, it's an ecosystem. Every part affects every other part in some way.
And when you put your electrodes on the head, you affect, in theory, a small area of the brain right under the electrodes. But it's already been shown that that effect can then multiply and spread throughout the nervous system, even down to your spinal cord.
Huh. I mean, there's a theory out there. It's called the zero-sum theory of the brain that some people use as a framework for thinking about all this, which is like, you know, one part goes up, another part goes, like, there's only so much juice in the brain. So if you send juice one direction, there's less juice somewhere else.
So then if you were enhancing one part, you're by definition diminishing another.
Maybe. And to be honest...
There was definitely an after effect.
This is kind of why I got so interested in this piece in the first place, is because of what happened to her after the sniper training.
So driving down from LA to Carlsbad to go do this was an absolute nightmare. I hadn't driven in like a year because I've been living in London where I just do public transportation. But on the way up, it's kind of like, I mean, I hate to compare it to Mario Kart, but it's just this extremely pleasant experience. I feel like I drove better that day than I ever drove before. Like, it was very obvious where I could pass people without irritating them. And just, I don't know, it's a weird memory, but I think I had more fun driving that day than I ever did since.
And at some point, she realized it wasn't just about her driving ability.
So I would say that, I mean, I don't know how much I want to get into sort of in public on the radio about, you know, being a bit anxious. I mean, I guess that's not particularly controversial. Probably all writers like are sort of riddled with anxiety. But, you know, I have this constant struggle with all the little angry gnomes in my head, you know, populating my head and telling me like all the things that I don't do right. And, you know, all the things that I've done wrong that day, they just keep this incredibly like comprehensive tally of them. And then, you know, the ones who worry about the future, and then, you know, the ones who tell me I'm going to be living in a cardboard box in a year. I mean, it's just like an amazing cacophony.
But she says, sitting in that car?
They were just completely turned off, I think, for a couple of days. And it was a really, you know...
Really? For a couple of days?
For a couple of days. And to tell you the truth, it was kind of like everything just... I was just this person that I hadn't experienced before. And I thought, maybe this is the actual sort of core person who I am when I'm not, when all my baggage isn't just weighing on me. It was like somebody had wiped a really steamy window. And I was just able to look at the world for what it was.
And I was curious whether like there's a connection there that like to be a good performer of some task goes along with shutting down the parts of yourself that say, I don't know, I don't think, maybe I can't, maybe I shouldn't. And that like there's actually a real connection between amping up one and tamping down the other.
I mean, it makes sense, because if you're giving one circuit more power, you might be taking away from other places.
Yeah.
It's funny. I mean, it does, I find this like, you know, since you and I have just been on stage, Robert, one of the things I struggle with most during the performances is I'm sitting there, we're both sitting there, we've got our scripts, and I have this box of buttons, and I have to remember which buttons do what things, and there's like the musicians, and I have to figure out where they come in and out. And all of these things, they become competing voices.
Yeah.
They become these little chattering gnomes that Sally puts it in my head, and I'm like, wait, when does that, hey, okay, now, when does that come in? Where are we? It's not a good feeling. And then there are other times where something happens, it's almost like a mode, and suddenly it's like, whoo, I'm right there. I know I'm right with you. It's the easiest thing in the world to listen to what you're saying and respond instinctively and in the moment. And they literally feel like different chemical modes or maybe electrical modes. You know what I mean?
That's very interesting to me. Because, I mean, going back to the performance stuff, you can't really make it happen. I mean, I guess you could, I suppose, but it doesn't feel that way. It feels like it's somehow... It
feels like it's a gift, you know? What happens when it's an expectation?
To tell you the truth, one of the really worrying things to me was afterward how much I craved doing it again. It felt like a drug with no side effects. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to get addicted to the electricity. Seems unlikely, but...
Gotta get some, man.
Shoplifting batteries.
Some licking them.
It's in the supermarket corner, licking 9-volt batteries.
Thank you, Soren.
No problem. And thanks a lot to Sally Ady.
Okay, so time to go to a break.
Yeah.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
Stay tuned.
Hi, Radiolab. This is Sally calling from Melbourne, Australia. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon slash not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program. That is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you either way for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
The word hit us like you're hit with a bullet. And we're like, that cannot be our son.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
This is Radio Lab, and our story today begins with a boy.
And that boy is going to vanish, not into thin air, but to a place that we know very, very little about.
And if you're the parent of that boy, what do you do if your child is falling away from everything you know?
How do you find him?
How do you get him back?
So part of this tale we got from Ron Suskind's new wonderful book, Life Animated, and some of you may have heard it, some not.
But let's start where Ron started. For him, it began around 1993.
And it was an exciting time.
Well, we're going into Owen's room for what is his last night in the crib.
I still can't watch.
In 1993, the Suskind family decided to make a big move. Ron and his wife, Cornelia.
Cornelia Suskind.
And their two sons, Walt and Owen.
Walter is about 5, and Owen is about 2.5.
They decide to relocate from Boston to Washington, D.C.
You know, I had this senior national affairs job at the Journal.
Good night.
Say nighty-night.
Night-night.
Kind of a dream job.
I love you.
Lots of excitement.
Have a nice last night near Cribby.
So they make the move. And as soon as they arrive in Washington,
we start sort of noticing something's amiss.
Their youngest son, Owen, who to that point had been a totally normal, chatty, almost 3-year-old.
He's hitting all of his markers.
Suddenly goes sideways.
Maybe the very first thing that happened was he stopped sleeping. He stopped eating. He was very fussy.
Initially, they figured, well, it's got to be the move.
And then we start losing eye contact. Then he starts losing motor skills. He can't hold his cup. It's slipping out of his hand. His gait became very odd. And he was sort of looked like a drunken sailor walking around the house. and then he stopped speaking bit by bit by bit.
And this was all compressed into a
few months.
A few months, really.
Yeah.
What could have occurred? Could he have banged his head, ingested something toxic? You know, first you hit the regular pediatrician, and he's gone, and he sent us to a center. There was a woman there.
Who sits them down?
And she says the word autism.
What did the word mean to you at that moment?
It meant Rain Man.
Dustin Hoffman.
Mean,
I'm a very good driver. Until we saw. And we're like, that cannot be our son.
You know, it was just terrifying.
Now, in reporting this story, we visited a school here in Manhattan called the Rebecca School. It's a really unique school for children with autism, other developmental delays. There's little kids in there, age 4, all the way up to, I think, even 21. Every kid that you meet in the school is different. Autism is a many, many flavored thing. But the overwhelming sense you get walking the halls there is that each of these kids is kind of locked away a little bit. Just, they don't know how to be with. Like, Kelsey Padgett and I, we got there during lunch, and in one of the rooms, I don't know, maybe you should describe this.
Yeah, there was this, we went to this one classroom where there was this one boy who really stood out. He was about 6 years old, and he had this big mop of black hair, and he was just standing there at the table holding an apple. And just sobbing.
Do you want to eat your apple? You don't want to eat the apple.
Who's that? And the director of the school, Tina McCourt, she was there, and she just stayed with the boy and really like tried to be there with him, but there was nothing she could do.
There goes the apple.
It was hard to watch. Because you don't know how to help him.
So that's a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. There's a kid who actually can't tell you what's upsetting to him, right?
That's Gil Tippy, the school's clinical director.
Could be that he actually doesn't know where he is in space, maybe. It's as if we were being thrown out of an airplane. Right, you're just tumbling, you don't know where your body is. It's a thunderstorm, so you only see things in flashes, right? So now the world is totally frightening. It's totally overwhelming.
I mean, I do remember the drive home from that terrible day.
I've blocked that out.
I just remember, you know, you and I driving home in silence with Owen in the back, and I just felt like, you know, There was no hope.
Like they had no idea if the Owen they knew was in there, or if he was just kind of lost to them, like gone. Now, keep in mind, this was 1994. We knew even less about autism than we know now. We still have no idea what causes autism. But then, the prevailing wisdom seemed to be that kids with autism, they couldn't feel emotion. They had no capacity to empathize with other people. This was way before the neurodiversity movement. Actually, right around the moment when autism was becoming a spectrum for the first time.
That's just happening in 1994, just starting.
Barely starting.
Yeah, really. At that point.
Owen was about 4. Was he active or was he?
Yeah, he was hyperactive. A lot of self-stimulatory behavior, you know, hand flapping, running around.
And Cornelia and Ron say that when they would call him, it was as if he didn't even hear them.
We're hoping he's hearing, you know, but he's not really responding.
Well, when you needed him to come to the table, or
you would basically
come...
have to go and lead him by the hand and or pick him up and bring him over.
Huh.
And he was down to one word, which was juice. So the only thing he was doing was drinking juice for about a year.
And also, you know, there was the Disney movies.
So he would sit for television entertainments or something.
He wouldn't sit for the whole movie for sure, but that would be the one thing that he would sit for quietly for periods.
You don't know what I've been through.
Because he didn't sleep, so at night I was usually up with him all night thrashing around.
And as Owen watched one Disney movie after another, not sleeping at all, that word juice, it seemed to expand just a little bit. He began to repeat the word.
Juicervos, juicervos, juicervos.
Wait, was he saying juicervos?
Juicervos.
juicer froze.
But you don't know what first what that is.
No. No, we think it's juice. Cornelia's like, I said, does he seem to want more juice? And she's like, no, I gave him more juice. He didn't seem to want it.
And Ron says he would say that word over and over for weeks, and they had no idea what it meant. Until.
It's about a year and a month after the symptoms have started.
One night, all four of them are together in the living room.
And we're watching The Little Mermaid.
Under the sea. Under the sea.
And at a certain point, Owen, who's got the remote, he starts rewinding the movie back a little bit to rewatch the scene.
It's typical. So Owen knows how to work the remote. Walt kind of showed him how to do it, and he took to that. And he's rewinding the part where Ariel,
if I become human,
our protagonist,
I'll never be with my father or sisters again,
wants to become human to get her man, Eric.
That's right.
And the sea witch, Ursula, says it will cost you.
Tough choices.
And the price is
your voice.
Your voice.
My voice?
You've got it, sweet cakes.
And all of a sudden, Ariel and Ursula are having it out.
Come on, you poor unfortunate soul!
And this part gets rewound again.
It won't cost much, just your voice.
And again.
All day, it won't cost much, just your voice.
And Walt's like, oh, and stop rewinding, just play the movie.
Okay, it won't cost much, just your voice.
But after the third rewind,
just your voice.
Cornelia says, oh. It's not juice. It's not juice. It's just.
Oh.
I said, what? Just your voice.
Just your voice.
At which point, I'm like, I grab him by the shoulders, and I'm like, just your voice, just your voice. And he starts going, juicer voice, juicer voice, juicer voice. And Walter starts jumping in the bed, crying and laughing and jumping on the bed.
Did you feel like he chose that phrase for a reason?
That's, of course, immediately what we thought.
He's trying to tell us something.
That, like, he has things to say, but he just can't say it. It's his voice. In other words,
he's in there.
He's in there because he's trying to talk to us.
So we run to the doctor, a very trusted guy, and he's like, oh, you know, sit down, let's talk. And he says, it's something called echolalia. It's echoing sounds. That their auditory processing, their ability to process the sound, speech,
language,
goes haywire. And so they just repeat the sound. And we're saying, so he doesn't know what it means. And he's like, probably not.
Life goes on. And years go by.
Where he's murmuring a lot of gibberish we might be able to decipher from some movie. Maybe. By six, he's got, you know, three-word sentences. I want juice. Just, you know, 1.5-year-old speech. Corn's there full-time, 24/7.
Ron's working around the clock.
In a kind of frenzy.
They pay for all the therapists.
And we're fighting it out, basically.
They see tiny, tiny bits of progress, but no more breakthroughs.
Until?
Owen's about 6.5, and Walt is 9. And Walter gets a little emotional on his 9th birthday.
I'm not sure, maybe the anxiety of the moment, of the attention of it.
This is Walt Susskind.
And how old are you now?
I'm 25.
In any case, Walt has his 9th birthday and his friends come over.
And then after the party, he's out in the hammock in the yard and he's kind of crying a little bit. And
Owen walks in after Walter is emotional and we're in the kitchen and he seems to kind of look back and forth between the two of us. In like there's something he wants to say.
To this point, Owen had only said three-word sentences, but in this moment, according to Ron,
he looks at us and says, Walter doesn't want to grow up like Mowgli or Peter Pan.
He says the full sentences.
Full thing, whole thing.
Wow.
I mean, literally, it was like a thunderbolt, a lightning bolt went through the kitchen. And Owen runs off in some, you know, reverie, whatever, and we look at each other and like, what was that? You know, this is his first complex sentence or thought that's been expressed, and it's a subtle one, actually.
Because he's taking three different characters, two from a movie, one from real life, and he's putting them together. So Ron is like, I gotta follow this. So he goes up to Owen's room.
And I see Owen on the bed looking at a Disney book, and I see on the carpet are some of his puppets, and one of them is Iago from Aladdin, the plush toy, you know, which is the $98 one that goes up to your elbow. And I grab it and I put it on on my arm, right up to the elbow. And I crawl along in the rug, and I throw the bedspread kind of over my head and just edge up to the edge of the bed. And I push the puppet up through the crease in the bedspread. And so now they're face to face, Owen and Iago. And I'm looking up through the crease, sort of up my arm. And I talk to him as Iago. Now, this is an easy voice. It's Gilbert Gottfried's voice. I mean, anyone can do this. I say, so, Owen, how does it feel to be you? And he turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. And he says, oh, not good. I'm lonely. And it was his voice.
Wow.
And so I say, so when did you and I become such good friends? And he says, when I watched Aladdin and you made me laugh. And we go back and forth like this for four or five more exchanges. And then I hear Owen clear his throat, like that. And then all of a sudden I hear him say back, I love the way your foul little mind works.
He said what?
I love the way your foul little mind works. That's Jafar, the villain. Iago's the villainous sidekick to Jafar, the villain of Aladdin.
Oh.
That's the next line from Jafar.
But you slipped into a
script.
You're
in the movie.
You're inside.
He's asking for me to respond as Iago.
Did you know the next line?
I didn't know the next line. At that point, I just jumped out from under the bedspread and said, Owen, what's going on?
So now they felt like, okay, he is in there. I mean, despite everything that they had been told about autism, Owen was in there, and somehow these Disney characters were in there with him.
It doesn't take us long that, you know, we start what we call the basement sessions, where we say, let's see how far this can go.
A couple times a week.
We go down in the basement and start playing out scenes. What, describe to these guys, what was it like when Mom and I started doing voices on Walter?
Felt amazed.
Who was amazed? You were amazed or they were amazed?
I was amazed.
This is Owen Susskind. He's 23 now.
Why were you amazed?
I was so surprised by my family. I could hear them respond better.
You're saying that when everybody was acting out the Disney movies, suddenly you could hear them better?
Right.
Huh.
So when people would talk to you not in the Disney movies, what do you remember about how they sounded?
A little weird.
Yeah?
Gibberish and rubbish.
Huh. Do you remember how you felt?
A little worried.
You told Mom once that you were scared.
I was scared.
Why did it feel good to watch them over and over again, that you kept wanting to watch them over and over again? How did that feel to you?
It felt comforting.
Comforting.
Felt comforting.
Why?
Because it would help me with reducing my autism.
How does a movie help a boy in Owen's condition? Stay tuned and we'll attempt some explanations.
My name is Joseph Thacker and I'm calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're going back to a story about a boy with a condition that nobody can quite pin down.
Now, we just heard that Owen, when he watches Disney movies, he feels comforted and that somehow the movie seems to dial down his autism. We were like, why would that be? How could a Disney movie, or any movie really, make that much difference?
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you pretty well. I'm just going to ask. We ended up taking the question to this guy.
Simon Baron Cohen.
He's a leading researcher in autism.
And I'm the director of the Autism Research Center at Cambridge University.
And Simon told us a couple of different things. First of all, he says that in the last few decades, our whole notion of what is happening in the mind of a child with autism has totally changed. We've sort of tossed out the Rain Man idea.
The idea that people with autism lack some inner life, I think that's completely false.
It's not necessarily that they can't feel emotion or empathy, he says, not at all. It's often a decoding problem. Like they have trouble decoding all of the information that's coming in. I mean, some studies have found that a lot of kids with autism literally have too many synapses in their brain. So it might be that the world is just coming in too loud.
I think often people with autism feel very lost and confused. There's so little predictability in the social world. You know, people come and go. They know 2 days are the same. People say things unexpectedly, they do things unexpectedly. And people with autism seem to need a lot of predictability.
We spoke to Temple Grandin, the well-known author and autism advocate, and here's how she put it.
When I was a little kid, I wanted to feel the nice feeling of being held, but there was just too much overwhelming stimulation. You know, loud sounds hurt my ears. Like the volume control on touch and hearing was way, way, way turned on.
As Temple Grandin explained it to us, a kid with autism gravitating to something like bus schedules or knowing every single fact about every dinosaur that ever lived, that is just a way to slow things down and make the world predictable so that it happens the same way every time. And as Simon Baron Cohen puts it, in Owen's case, he had these Disney movies that he could play over and over and over and over.
And then the fact that it's, you know, it's not just repetition, but it's repetition about human action.
Jasmine, where are you?
Out in the menagerie. Hurry.
You know, that creates a kind of structure to be able to look at human behavior. You know, in the real world, there's no opportunity to rewind the movie.
Oh, wait a minute, Jafar!
Whereas in the world of movies, you can watch the same Disney cartoon 100 times or 1,000 times, and you could almost go frame by frame. Like a literary critic or a film critic, you could really analyze the action to understand, okay, that's what happened, and that's what caused him to do what he did.
Add to that
the element of music.
We spoke with Professor Geraldine Dawson, a neuroscience professor at Duke, who guessed that maybe it's not just the repetition that made the difference, but the repetition with music.
One of the things that we've learned from neuroscience is that music activates emotional centers in our brain. And in fact, it's pretty reliable that certain kinds of music make us feel, you know, frightened, make us feel happy, make us feel worried, and so forth.
Now, she says when scientists have done brain scans of kids with autism, they found
that during kind of normal interactions, people with autism don't necessarily activate those emotional centers of the brain, areas like the amygdala.
But during the experience of music, those areas of the brain did become activated in a way that was very much like a typical person.
So it might be that while Owen was sort of forensically examining these moments of Disney movies, it was the Disney music that was binding those moments to feelings. So he could know, like, oh, when a person looks like that, that's when they're happy. When a person looks like that, that's when they're sad. However it works, Simon Baron Cohen thinks it's at least plausible.
That is using the movie as a scaffold to make sense of the much greater complexity of natural life.
And that's what got to Ron Suskind.
Like, wow, this is a whole new planet here.
That maybe this Disney-ish therapy that they use with Owen might be a whole new approach to treating kids with autism.
Instead of the one-size-fits-all model of sit in the class and hear the things you're supposed to know to be a working member of society, instead it's like go with their passion, follow them in there. It's a pathway, the brain finding a way to get to what people need, which is interaction and emotional wholeness.
Here, I want you to sing the song for them.
The seaweed is always greener. It's a party at Sis Lake. You dream about going up there, but that is a big mistake. Just still got to win.
Over the years, sometimes down in the basement with the family, or sometimes even in doctor's offices, Owen started to improvise. He'd go off script and use the characters he knew so well to explain how he was feeling.
Under the sea, darling, it's better that way. It's better to take it from me.
And as we were thinking about all this and asking ourselves, you know, if this works with Disney movies, which are very emotional and clear, how do you do this with paper clips or bus schedules? And as the questions kept coming, we ran into, inevitably, a counter-reaction to Ron's story. And this we didn't expect.
The story is great. It's a wonderful story. But the fact is, the danger with a book, with any book, including Life Animated, is that it's going to give the impression to a lot of people that this is the answer.
You know, it's kind of like, that's psychologist and journalist David Royko, and he warned us that, like,
with autism,
we still don't really know much, and we don't have yet a body of established science, and all the anecdotes you're hearing, they're just anecdotes.
If you've known one person with autism, you've known one person with autism.
That, he says, is really all you can say, and to take one person's experience and generalize on it, it's a mistake. A case in point, his son, Ben.
Ben is turning 21 years old today.
Oh, my God. Happy birthday to him.
Thanks. And, Ben is never going to be able to live independently. He's never going to have what anyone would consider a full and normal life.
Ben has severe autism and is now living in an assisted living facility. He was diagnosed around the same age as Owen. Same basic symptoms.
Lack of eye contact.
Sudden loss of speech.
Fascination with spinning wheels, with ceiling fans. The whole package.
Dave says he and his wife tried every therapy they could afford, and a whole lot they couldn't. But Ben never had any of those big breakthroughs. Instead, even as a teenager,
he would hit and he would scratch and he would bite and he would punch and he would kick.
And honestly, the reason we ended up calling Dave is because he wrote a review of Ron's book where he said, basically, it's a great book, but it's just one more story of a triumphant, happy ending. And that is not the norm.
For many, many people who experience autism, you don't have happy endings. I mean, that's a sad fact for many of these families. And we're not expecting in our life a happy ending for Ben.
People seem to believe that it's dangerous for parents to have too much hope, because what if they really think it's possible for their child to progress a huge amount or recover, and then their child doesn't? We have the other concern.
That's Ron Kaufman of the Autism Treatment Center of America.
We find that we're not afraid of so-called false hope. We're more concerned about false pessimism.
And here's why he says that. In 1981, Ron's dad, Barry Kaufman,
and I'm Oprah Winfrey.
He sits down on a local TV show with a very young Oprah Winfrey, and he describes his experience.
Okay, we had a child who was diagnosed as incurably ill or hopelessly ill, something called autism.
He tells how at a really young age, a year and a half old, his son began to regress and began to flap hands, lose eye contact, rock back and forth. And then one day, he and his wife decided, you know what, we're going to just sit down on the bathroom floor right next to him, and we're going to rock back and forth just like him. And he explains that they did this over and over and over, hour after hour, until one day his son turned his head.
And he actually looked at us. It took 900 hours before he ever gave us eye contact on his own. When he looked at us, we cheered. We cried, because that was really big for us. And so somebody else might look at us and say, you're crazy. But we're not. We just got this little boy. It took us 900 friggin' hours, but he just looked at us for 3 seconds. My God.
And he went from that to a little boy now who functions on a near genius level, who talks, is communicative, is loving, and is embracing.
And that little boy is Ron.
For me, it just felt like my mother was loving me and enjoying me and playing with me.
Nowadays, in interviews, Ron seems to say that maybe his parents cured him of autism.
I actually have never used the word cure. I don't use that in my lectures, YouTube videos. No one's ever actually heard me say that. What I do say is full recovery, which is essentially the same thing.
Whatever you call it, armed with his heroic story, Ron and his dad, Barry, now run an autism treatment program that they call Sunrise, S-O-N-Rise.
People come here from all around the world and say, my child is severely autistic. And I will smile and I'll put out my hand and I'll shake their hand and I'll say, I am so excited for you. Wow, you are so blessed. And you know what they'll start to do? They'll cry, and I'll say, why are you crying? No one ever said that to me.
You really say that to parents with a severely autistic kids? Severely.
I say it all over the world.
You know, last year, there was a woman named Kelly Stapleton, who was a fairly prominent autism blogger, and I'd gotten to know Kelly a bit.
She has a daughter with autism, and one day when her daughter was 14,
she locked herself in a van with a couple charcoal burners and tried to commit suicide with her autistic daughter. You see that in the world of autism more than, I can't think of any other place you see it.
Dave believes that one of the reasons you see so many suicides in this community, and by the way, there's a huge debate about this on the web, but he believes that one of the reasons you see it so much is that all these success stories seem to say to parents like him, that as hard as it can be, and it can be really, really hard, you're not trying hard enough.
It's depressing. Autism, it destroys lives, is what it does in our definition of it.
And that's one of the things that makes it very, very confusing for people outside the community to describe what's going on, because you now have this situation where obviously all autism is a spectrum. And so you have all of these different kids described by the same word, making things even more confusing.
If you take a child when they're 2 or 3.
That's Temple Grandin again.
You can have 2 kids that look real severe. And I looked real severe when I was 3. Real, real severe. And then you work on these kids. Lots of one-on-one therapy. And one kid, you kind of pull them out of it. And the other one, you're not able to pull them out of it. And they both look the same at age 3.
So if a lot of these kids start out with the same set of symptoms, but they end up in vastly different places, no one knows why, then as a parent, you really have no idea what is going to happen or how much you can dare to hope.
Notions of what could be up the road or what should be now, if they pop into my head, which is rare, I dismiss them. I have absolutely no idea. Because we have been down so many roads that were disappointing.
After Owen's Disney basement sessions had really taken off and the Disney therapy, as it were, seemed to be working and Owen was getting better and better and better,
things took a turn, and not for the good.
Remind me how old he is at this point?
14?
14.
Yeah. 15?
Oh, so, okay.
14, yeah.
Ninth grade.
Ninth grade. It was 10th grade.
Oh, right.
10th grade.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
And what happened?
We didn't know what was happening. You know, we just saw over the months that Owen was really out of sorts.
He got quiet, kind of withdrawn, basically stopped doing Disney. Over this period, he's losing a lot of weight.
He's not sleeping.
The three of us were scratching our heads saying, what is going on with Owen? He is really moving into a bad place. I mean, I was actually worried that he was becoming schizophrenic.
Oy, yeah, I still think about that whole scenario all the time because we knew something was wrong with Owen and we couldn't get it out of him.
This is Owen's older brother, Walt, again, and he says when he pick up Owen from school...
He was just a shell of himself. He would talk to himself, I'd pick him up, and he would talk to himself in the car, and it'd be, no, or, you know, it's not true, or something under his breath.
And then...
At one point, I overhear him in a kind of conversation with Phil, the sidekick of Hercules, and Phil is, you know, listen, kid, you can take him, you know, you gotta stand up for yourself, that kind of thing that Owen was saying, and I didn't know where to fit it in.
Ron says it seemed like Owen was trying to psych himself up for something, so he sat down with Owen on the couch and he grilled him for an hour until eventually Owen told him about his music class at school.
There are two kids in this class who are ED kids, emotionally disturbed kids, so they're not on the autistic spectrum, and socially they're very on target. And they basically torment and terrorize him for 6 months of that school year, unbeknownst to us and unbeknownst to the school.
What did they do?
They sat on either side of him and basically said, you know, we're going to kill you, we're going to kill your parents.
And those two bullies lied and bullied me badly.
I mean, right then you were in a very bad spot.
Yeah.
And you couldn't tell me or mom or anyone.
Right.
Because what happened? The bully said what?
Burn your house down.
If what?
If you tell.
Right.
And Owen was so literal, as are so many autistic kids. He believed that they literally meant they were going to come and burn his house down.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's an extraordinary moment in the middle of this where Walter picks him up and Owen starts to go through a calculus. The bully said, if you tell your parents about what we said, we'll burn your house down. But they said nothing about your brother.
Oh.
And so he sees like an opening.
Yeah.
And so did you tell him?
No, I didn't.
Why not?
Because I'm afraid he would beat them up. I didn't want that.
Walt, at this point, you know, is a football player, and, you know, he looks like Hercules to Owen, and Owen later describes to us this thinking that if he tells Walter that Walter will hurt the kid and maybe kill the kid, and in Disney, none of the heroes actually kill any of the villains.
No.
Walter was the hero. You were afraid he was going to do what?
Kill.
Yeah.
But it's wrong.
I just remember finding out, and it was like a combination of, like, rage and helplessness. I really wanted to kill that kid. I mean, I'm his protector.
In a way, you were kind of... Walter was worried about protecting you in that time.
Yeah.
In a way, it was...
Me.
That was doing what?
Protecting myself.
And who else?
And my brother.
Right, and Walt.
And Walt.
You're protecting Walter.
Yeah.
So here you had this moment where it looked like Owen was sliding backwards, but according to Ron, it might have actually been his greatest leap forward. His most profound moment of empathy.
These days, Owen is 23, just turned 23 a few months ago.
And are you in love right now?
Yes, I am, with the girl of my dreams, Emily. She and I graduated from Riverview last month.
This has been a 3-year program called Getting Ready for the Outside World.
Grow, yeah.
And so he'll be graduating from the entire program?
Yep. And off on his own.
And now, me, her, and our other two friends, John and Julie, also go to school, are all going to move and live at Life in Hyannis.
What is Life?
Living independently forever.
And what is it? What kind?
An adult independent living program.
As we were talking, it was hard not to wonder how independent will Owen be, because that's the question that's in front of the Susskinds now, especially Walt.
I think what scares me sometimes is kind of just having to go it alone in a lot of ways. I'll just have to be ready to take these things on, kind of.
But we talk to him about, you know, about everything, about, you know, our will and who will be Owen's, you know, how he figures into everything.
All the efforts of what we're trying to do and have been doing for all this time is to... One of our favorite movies is The Jungle Book, because Mowgli's, it's his quest with his animal sidekicks to get him to the man village. What we have been doing all this time and what we're still doing and we do every day is to bring Owen closer and closer to that man village that we all inhabit. There's so much hope in that, and as he progresses, you feel so good about it. But at the same time, that's not to say he'll ever totally get there. As hard as we might try, we may not get him there. But that doesn't mean you leave him on the path. You stay with him on the path, even if it's a never-ending path.
Thanks to Ron Susskind, Cornelia Susskind, Walt Susskind, Owen Susskind, the whole Susskind family, and Mr. Susskind's book. Ron's book is called Life Animated.
Thanks also to Jonathan Freeman, Elaine Hall, Steve Silberman, Pamela DeDelvore, and Kelsey Padgett.
And sincere thanks also to Gil Tippy and to Tina McCourt at the Rebecca School, and to the whole staff at that school. They're all heroes in my mind here. So, here you go.
There you go. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Thanks for listening.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.